Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, today we're going to talk about a lot of movies, probably.
Yeah,
this is episode number 111. And we're going to talk about a documentary film called Life Itself, which is about the film reviewer extraordinaire named Roger Ebert, who most of us have probably heard of.
I guess in so many ways he was the quintessential American reviewer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he died in 2013. Was born in 1942 and was a film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times from 1967 until he died.
Yeah, 40 something years.
Yeah. Right.
I remember, even when he was really sick, I would still go to his site every week to see what he wrote. And he was still reviewing very current movies, you know.
Well, I still go there.
Yeah.
You know, often in prep for a podcast, you know, after I've seen the movie, mm-hmm. I'll see if Ebert reviewed it, you know, if it's an old enough film. And he reviewed almost everything right up till 2013.
Oh my gosh. So, yes, he did.
Yeah. He said something like, I've seen 40,000 movies or something like that. It's unbelievable.
Yep.
There it is. No, not 40,000. It says, in the past 25 years, I've probably seen 10,000 movies and reviewed 6,000 of them. I have forgotten most of them, I hope, but I remember those worth remembering, and they are all on the same shelf in my mind. And that was from the movie, which may have been from the book. Yeah, Life Itself is also a book. Mm-hmm. That I started at one point, but had to break away from, you know, due to things that were going on, you know, work and everything. But it's called Life Itself, a Memoir.
Did you like it?
I liked everything that I read up to the point, yeah. And he talked in the opening of the book, he talked mostly, like in the movie, about his marriage to Chaz and, you know, how he was loved by that family and stuff. But we'll certainly get into that.
Right. I went and found that documentary actually at the library after I saw this, which I liked very much. And thank you for picking it because it's one of those that, you know, I meant to get around to. But, you know, I've got a lot of other things to watch. It's not so compelling that I was just going to leap out there and get it. So,
yeah.
Especially considering I knew that a lot of it was right before he died and his face had been changed so much by his disease that I was dreading that part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it seems like the director was a guy named Steve James. And
Did he do Hoop Dreams?
Hoop Dreams?
Did he do other documentaries?
I'm looking right now.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, Hoop Dreams. That's correct.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, he looks like he's done several of them. Several.
Yeah, I thought he was pretty well known.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay. At the very opening of the movie, I wish that I had watched it. You know, I've seen the movie twice, but I wish I had watched that first part again right before the podcast because it seemed to me as if he had kind of a grand plan that was a little bit more than the life of Roger Ebert. It sounded like he really wanted to get into movies and review, you know, history of film. Did you get that impression from something that he said? Or am I off base here?
Well, you know, I saw it once, so I don't remember.
So, regardless of that, the movie turned out to be something completely different than the filmmaker set out to do. Because he did not expect... You know, Roger Ebert passed away during the filming of this movie. And that's not what he set out to do. He did not set out to document the last days of Roger Ebert. He thought that he was making a film with Roger Ebert about film and maybe the life of Roger Ebert as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out to be something completely different. And so it contains a lot of that, a lot of the life of Roger Ebert and a lot of talk about his reviewing philosophy, kind of a populist philosophy, kind of what we do here, I'd like to think. you know, him and Gene Siskel were like, you know, hey, anybody can talk about movies, you know, and we become passionate about movies. And
it seemed as if it was three movies in one, but they worked together well. It was his last days. It was his life. And it was also about kind of, in a way, the history of movie criticism in America. Not going right back to the first, but how it developed from, what, the 1960s when it was just in the newspaper onto these days.
Mm.
And so because it had those layers, because Roger Ebert was involved in all that, it made it more interesting, I think, than the regular, the life of so-and-so.
Yeah, I think so, too. And the filmmaker did a fabulous job, I thought, you know, of, you know, I like how you put that. It's three movies, but how it was cut together and how the stories meshed.
There was one thing he did that I didn't like, but we'll talk about that.
Okay.
It's not a big thing, but we can talk about that later.
Okay, sure. Gotcha.
But in general, yes, I agree. It was much more interesting than I thought because it had all those layers. And also, because, you know, I remember when I met and was dating Tom, who's my husband, I had never heard of that at the movies or sneak previews or whatever it was called then that Siskel and Ebert did. It had been showing in selected areas around the country, and Houston public TV was always really, they were the first public TV station in the country, and always very quick on some of that stuff. And so my husband had been watching it, and I met him, and I was like, what? No, I never heard of this. And I was just captivated from the beginning. So watching those sections especially, I really connected with it. And so for me, one of the immediate things was it was so good to hear Roger Ebert's voice. You know, my daughter Rose doesn't know that. When I talked to her and said it was so good to hear his voice, she goes, oh, what did he sound like? And I was like, oh, I'm sorry that you never really saw him on TV. She read him.
Yeah, and that's my memory of Roger Ebert, too. You know, before the internet existed, I remember him on TV when I was a kid, and I would watch. I always enjoyed that show whenever I saw it. Yeah, who knows what it was called. At the movies, sneak previews. I think the title changed three times. Siskel and Ebert at the movies.
Right.
I laugh because of a scene in the movie where they were trying to film. They didn't get along very well. It's funny. But yeah, we can get there. but at the very opening of the movie, they showed Roger Ebert saying, it seemed to be his thought about what the value of movies is. And that is, you know, shared experience. He was talking about how, you know, you experience the life of another person, and a movie is a good way to do that.
Yeah.
And I like that because I feel the same way.
Oh yeah.
With stories in general. Yeah.
Right. That's what stories do. And a quote that I wrote down, which must have been from that part, was the movies are like a machine that generates empathy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I really like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess you need to be careful, don't you? Because, you know, a movie can create empathy, but, you know, it can also generate untruth, right?
Yeah. You have to come away from it and say that was a historical movie, but that's not necessarily a factual movie.
Mm-hmm.
And even a documentary is shown through what the director wants you to see.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
and this,
everything is the story being told.
Yeah. One of the things that I was thinking when I was watching it is they talked a little bit about Roger Ebert knowing some of the actors.
Yeah.
He didn't know them at the beginning, but as his career progressed, he went to Cannes Film Festival and he was in LA and all this stuff. He would interview people. He got to know them. They liked him, right? So as time went on, he got criticized for, well, you know Clint Eastwood. How should I believe this review that you wrote about Pale Rider or whatever?
Right.
And but they used to say, well, the critics used to be, you know, it was the critics and the movie makers used to all be in the same crowds, you know, and so Roger Ebert was like a throwback to that.
Yeah, well, and even in the theater, I think the history of the theater was like that too.
Right, right.
You know, from before then. So, well, and he was just, I was really interested when they were talking also about his journalistic career. And I remember when I was reading some of the reviews of the movies, of this movie, I'm sorry, they would say, well, looks like he was really pretty much a jerk when he was young. And so I was interested to see that part. And I was like, he was no more of a jerk than anyone who was clever, quick, insightful, and had a personality, and people flocked to it. And yes, then you go overboard. You're a young man, you're in Chicago, it's your game, you're going to be out there. But I didn't see anything that meant he wasn't, that he was particularly unpleasant more than any other person.
Yeah, and I agree with that.
You know,
I agree with that.
And so
that,
yeah. I was glad to see that, mm-hmm. you know. He was just a guy getting going in the journalism game.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and this movie is kind of, he was part of the making of this film.
Right.
So it's, he was the subject, but he also affected what was filmed. So it's almost like this movie is kind of like how his life was, you know what I mean?
Right.
Where, you know, his reviews may have been you know, affected by the fact that he knew the people he was talking about. And now he's got the movie where, you know, he's affecting the movie by, you know, like when they were irrigating his throat at one time, it was him who wanted it filmed. And, you know, when it was done, he was like, I think we got that on film. He's like, yes, we got it.
I was more like Chaz. I was like, you know, privacy is okay.
In that's right.
Some of these circumstances, you don't have to be out there. Well, and also, here's one of the things I always loved about Roger Ebert, and I guess this is starting to turn into a reminiscence of our part about him. But,
and it should be, because that's what the film is, too.
Well, because here's the thing. One of the things I loved about him on the TV show was he was able to do something, and I generally have to say I would a lot of times agree with Gene Siskel more, but what Roger Ebert could do is look at like a kid's movie and say, well, it doesn't matter if I liked it as an adult. This was for children. He was brutally honest. He could divorce himself from that. And I won't say now because if people haven't seen it, but there's a scene later where they're talking about this criticism that he's friends with these people. And then they show a review he did on TV. And I mean, it just cut somebody off at the knees. And it was somebody who he'd helped get the career going. They were friends. He didn't care. This is how he saw the movie. So you also saw that reflected in his journal, his online journal, which he started after his voice was messed up by surgery for his cancer. And I loved to read it. I often did not agree with him on stuff, but it didn't matter because you knew he was honestly telling you stuff. And if he could talk and he and I were in the room, we'd have been like Gene Siskel and him. But it's because he was passionate about the truth as he saw it. And he was pretty good at cutting away the personal stuff. Nobody's perfect at it, but I always really admired that about him.
Yeah, and I did too. And they said in the movie as well that Siskel, I can't remember, I think it might have been Chaz that was talking, but she was saying that Ebert was not a super outspoken person. He wasn't a person to fight.
But, Roger Ebert?
Yeah. But then she said that I guess, you know...
Really?
Yeah, but that was in the movie. And then she said that his relationship with Siskel was like a brotherly thing. And he did love to fight. So Ebert had to learn how to fight.
Well, she probably said that, but that was not the feeling I got from listening to everybody talking.
Uh-huh.
Because you got different people shading things different ways.
Sure, yep.
And I think, was it the wife who said, Gene Siskel's wife, who said that she felt like by the end it was like a brotherly relationship?
Mm-hmm.
somebody had said that basically it was like Gene Siskel was the older brother Roger Ebert never got, but Roger Ebert was the only child, so he was used to having everything his way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And both of them were so passionate about what they thought that they were just never going to back down, because that's what brothers do. Who can push your button more than somebody who's so much like you? You know, so that was more the feeling, because – you know, when Gene Siskel died and he hadn't told anybody about it, including Roger Ebert, you know, that cut him to the quick.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I completely understand it.
Yeah. That was sudden. My goodness.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's that thing of, do you want to, you know, you have brain cancer. You've got a year, maybe. Do you want everybody to watch you die, or do you want to just live? Because what's kind of interesting in this movie is we're seeing Roger Ebert take really kind of the exact opposite tactic of Gene Siskel. He found out he had brain cancer, but he had fairly young children, didn't want them to just think of him that way at the end, toward the end, you know, the whole last time they were with him. And so just kind of hid it from everyone except immediate family. And then Roger Ebert, who said, "I will never do this. I will be up front and out there." And he was so out there.
And not only was he out there, he was very positive. He mm-hmm. wasn't out there lamenting. You know, I'm sure he had bad days, but I was struck by his attitude. It reminded me of Pope John Paul II. At the end of his life, he could have chosen. In fact, people were asking him to resign. You know, I can't say who was. It's certainly not everybody. But I remember him, you know, people saying, "Well, you know, he's really, you know, he's old. He can't do what he used to. He ought to step down for the good of the church," right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "Well, no." You know, and what he did is he showed us all how to do it. And that's what Roger Ebert did.
Yeah.
You know, I felt that there was that similarity.
Mm-hmm.
It's admirable. You know, I hope that that's how I can handle it.
Yeah, I don't know if I could have held on as long as he did.
Yeah.
And I kind of loved the scenes where they'd show him coming home from the hospital one time.
Yeah.
And Chaz is trying to get him to now do it the way they showed you do. And I've been in this situation. And the person, and he's like, "No, I want to do it like this." But he couldn't talk or anything. But you could just see him from the back. He'd just be gesturing so angrily. And you're just like, "Oh, they're fighting now. You know, here you go."
Yeah.
That's the real person.
Right, right.
You know? And I really kind of like that, because that's how it goes. Those real, you know, those moments aren't all wonderful.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're not expected to be in a, you know, have a good attitude forever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just admirable to do what you can do.
Right.
But, I thought it was remarkable what he did, you know, on camera anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just being able to, and in his writing, I mean, to be able to continue to write reviews right up to the end, and not only that, mm-hmm, but just to write that blog and to write the book he wrote. It's really something else. You know, he's an example to all of us on how to do that.
Oh, yeah, because what I really loved is that he did find a different sort, or maybe a deeper voice when he couldn't talk anymore. I remember reading a blog post he wrote saying, "Now, everywhere he went, he thought about how would he blog it." And I was like, "Yep, everybody who blogs knows that feeling. You hit that, and that's where you go." And he was writing about everything that he was thinking. And watching this, it occurred to me that, you know, one of the things we all would be terrified of is being just stuck in your head. You're paralyzed, or you can't talk, and you can't express yourself. But because he was able to do that, he was just as expressive, if not more so, and had just as much say as any speaking person. I'm sure it was frustrating a lot of the time, but it was, like you say, it was admirable. He wasn't letting himself get shut down.
Right. I remember reading a blog post. I can't tell you what year it was, but I remember reading the blog post where he was talking about, "Well, I've got no jaw. I can't eat anything ever again. And, you know, I'm fed through a tube and things." And I'm reading that going, "Oh, my gosh." you know, this poor guy. But that's not how he was presenting it. It was not negative. He was like, this is something that happens. And, yeah, I mean, it's not something to jump up and down and be happy about, but, you know, I'm not going to let it stop me. I'm just going to keep going.
Well, and that's the thing where, as a Catholic, I look at it and go, we, of course, in this documentary, and the reason the documentary was made is we valued him as Roger Ebert, who had given so much to our lives about movies and everything.
Yeah, both of us. Yeah.
Right.
I think we both liked him
and
before.
And the guy who made it and everybody who watched it and loved him. But look at the grandchildren and Chaz, and they knew him for who he was, and this is the thing I'm trying to get to. His life had value, whether he could write or not. And so even when he couldn't do those things, when he had those bad days, and say he hadn't been able to go on writing, his life still had value no matter what shape he was in.
Absolutely.
And he was affecting every one of those people no matter what, because what I started doing very early on was just looking at his eyes. His eyes were the same. And with his eyes, as my husband said, my husband kept saying, he just keeps smiling. Things happen and you could see it with his eyes. He's smiling. He's laughing. He's expressing himself with his eyes. He's like, he's there. It's him.
Yeah. Yep.
But how many people, if you don't have the perfect life, who was that? It was a husband and wife who they were getting older. They were British or something. They're starting to like go deaf or blind or both or something. And they went to Switzerland and killed themselves because their quality of life wouldn't be very good. And I just like, well, maybe, but you don't know until you live it. That's what we're afraid of because we haven't been there.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it the best it could be? No. But as he himself, as Roger Ebert said, I've had a good, full, rich life.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah, very well put. Yeah. But yeah, you're exactly right. And he was loved. I mean, if you want to know what kind of person he was, you just look at how his family loved him, you know.
One of the best parts, and I can't believe I feel like I'm tearing up here, but one of the most wonderful parts was the home videos of him on vacation with, you know, his wife and her children and their grandchildren in Europe, Prague, I think it was, or somewhere like that. And just those dumb moments that you capture, waving, carrying around somebody's stuffed animal because they don't want to carry it anymore, that kind of thing. And I'm just like, those are the moments when he was able to be, you know, when you're expressing your artistic side, and that's what his movie critiques were, that's when you're very much yourself. But that's, those other moments were also him being himself.
Yeah.
That's the person, if no one else knew him, that's the person everybody loved. That was the person who had value in everyone's eyes. God's eyes, our eyes, everyone's eyes.
Yeah, and while we're talking about this, let's get into the deep stuff. All the way up till the end, I mean, he was accepting all sorts of suffering, but at the very, very end, he signed a do not resuscitate order, and passed away very shortly after. And he did that without the approval of his wife. She was not in the room. He knew that she would not allow that. And in an incredibly touching moment, when Chaz was describing that last moments with him, how she had peace come over her, she was going to fight it, and she was going to demand that they resuscitate him despite the order. But then the peace came over her, and she realized that she had to let this go. That deeply affected me. I watched that, and you know, as a Catholic, you know, I remember I asked you after I saw that. I was like, okay, you know, I need to make sure that as a Catholic, I understand. I mean, is it okay to do that? You know, does that in line with our teachings? Because I was, you know, curious, and it turns out that it is. What he did there, and I can read a piece of the catechism, and I realize we ought to be extremely careful here, because these are such sensitive issues. But I was, he basically said, we've gone as far as is reasonable.
And he was tired of fighting.
And he was tired, right.
And everything was going wrong, thing after thing after thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just think you get to a point where you know it's time.
Yeah. And he was emailing the filmmaker, too. The filmmaker was sending him emails. And all the way up to the end, I keep saying the filmmaker as if he's not a person. Steve James. Yeah. Steve James was emailing him question after question, which is the way Ebert requested that they continue. He said, I'm going to be in the hospital. Just keep sending me questions. And that moment where Ebert was finished was really poignant, too. You know, Steve would send him a question and, you know, it wouldn't come back or whatever. And he'd say, you know, why did you call your book Life Itself? And then he just wrote back, I can't. And that was
it. Yeah, that was, this would distract us from the point you were going to make about mm-hmm. what the Catholic teachings are. But that's where I got mad at the filmmaker.
Okay.
I felt like from the beginning, he sent him 9 pages of questions. Roger Ebert says, why don't you send me one question at a time?
Yeah.
And I'm going, look how long he's been sick. Look at the kind of shape he's in. You've been around him. You can see this. And at the very end, when he's like, oh my gosh, he's in the hospital again. Okay. He says he can't really type very well. I better send him my 4 most important questions. I start prioritizing questions. I'm like, you dummy. You should have been doing this from the beginning. If you want to know these deep questions, you should have been asking him that and not, what are your favorite places in Chicago? Which sounds like a first date question. Now, I liked where the answers led us to those simple questions. That was fine. But if he wasn't already prioritizing, he was not very smart. I'm saying it. I'm sticking by it. And then he's bothering Chaz. Well, I can't get a hold of him. What's going on? Blah, 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 blah. Now, by then he was probably so much a part of that group, you know, that it was okay. But from the outside, it looked incredibly insensitive to me. I was like, back off, man.
And as far as prioritizing his questions, I believe it was a surprise to everybody that he ended up back in the hospital. Because he went home.
But it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I can't defend him.
Yeah, don't you ask your best questions first?
Yeah, you bet. You bet.
I mean, anyway, I'm sorry. I'm going to be a Gene Siskel to your Roger Ebert.
That very still affected me. I hadn't really thought of that way, yeah. But yeah, should I read just the piece of the catechism?
Yeah, it's not the only statement in there about all this. There's probably a very careful lead up and going on, and there's also a papal document that's on from John Paul II on end of life issues and all this sort of thing.
Yeah,
that's a separate document that came out when Terry Schiavo. Case was out there, which is raising a whole nother question that I don't want to get into right now. We could put a link to her situation, but anyway.
Okay. I'm just going to read the Catechism 2278. It says, discontinuing medical procedures that are burdensome, dangerous, extraordinary, or disproportionate to the expected outcome can be legitimate. It is the refusal of overzealous treatment. Here, one does not will to cause death. One's inability to impede it is merely accepted. The decisions should be made by the patient if he is competent and able, or if not, by those legally entitled to act for the patient, whose reasonable will and legitimate interests must always be respected. So, yeah.
Which is exactly what happened, because he was sparing Chaz by not dragging her through, and he probably didn't want to fight about it. He knew she didn't want to let him go, which was also touching.
It was. I like their relationship a lot.
Oh.
It was a good partnership.
Well, and everybody agreed that when he married Chaz, he changed.
Mm-hmm.
He became a calmer, you know, so maybe when Chaz was saying he didn't like to fight, maybe that was her experience. But he, you know, it was basically he was who he should be, essentially. And isn't that what marriage should do for all of us?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he was kind of a playboy before that, but as much as he could be, it sounded like. But I loved that once he met her, that was it. I still remember.
He was like 50.
Yeah, he was 50.
I think it's great.
Right. And she'd had a couple kids who were grown up, and that's how they had grandchildren already. And so that was another remarkable thing to me, is in those home movies, I really suddenly got this look at him. And I didn't realize until maybe a couple years ago that Chaz was black.
Mm.
I just knew he got married. I didn't know anything about her.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, okay, not a big deal. And then in those home movies, what you see is he's the only white person in this very large group of a black family.
Yeah.
And you quite often, the way it's presented, and I don't know if this is just the movies I'm thinking of or when I see mixed couples, but it's not that way. It's the black person has been pulled into the white family quite often.
Mm.
And my husband said the same thing. And I said, I just find this so lovely that he loved the family and embraced it and was just ready to be kind of absorbed by them. Yeah. You know, like, here I am in the middle of this family. I love it.
Yeah, that's what I think that's, for all I think that that's time, something that, you know, just draws me to him, even in his movie reviews. Yeah. You know, you think the words life itself, right? That's what he was writing about. That's what he was celebrating all the time in everything that he wrote.
Right.
But to him, this was like, I'm to be embraced, you know, not to be shied away from, but to be embraced and to be experienced and to be loved. I just find that aspect of truth.
And he's like, I don't care what color these people are. These are the people I love.
Yeah.
I have found the love of my life. These are the people she loves and the people I love. So what?
Yeah.
You know, I just loved it.
I think that's so great. Now, Roger Ebert, he was raised Catholic. Mm-hmm. But he was not like a practicing Catholic, right? He wasn't a church-going Catholic for his adult life, as far as I could tell.
No, although he wasn't one of those people, though, who left the church and then would just bash it for the fun of it or because he was mad at it.
Absolutely not.
He would always make his own judgment calls on stuff. And
that just reminded me of something that made me laugh.
Oh, go ahead.
You remember, I think it was in the podcast on Salem's Lot. Was it on Salem's Lot? He was talking about vampires and how Catholics have the best weapons. I mean, how did that go? Yeah. What was that movie?
Yes, like, we got the best stuff. We got the priest, the holy water.
Yeah, he's like, you know, it's getting rough when they call the Catholics out there to fight it. You know, I thought that was so cool. But wasn't that Salem's Lot? Maybe it wasn't. What movie was that
review? I think that was actually his review of a movie called Vampires, which was based on a book called Vampires by John Stakely from Dallas, which I've read. And I think that's why I came across it. I have not seen the movie that was based on it, but he reviewed it, and that's
what
he
said. Yeah, I just called it up. Yep. Yeah, when it comes to fighting vampires and performing exorcisms, the Roman Catholic Church has the heavy artillery. Your other religions are good for everyday theological tasks, like steering their members into heaven, but when the undead lunge up out of their graves, you want a priest on the case. As a product of Catholic schools, I take a certain pride in this preeminence. I love it.
Well, that's like one of the outtakes times when they showed him and Gene Siskel agreeing, and he was like, "Props, since 600 years ago, this was going on. It was the Catholics," and Gene Siskel's like, "Yeah, and my people were doing this," and they're bumping fists, going, "Those other religions, give me something that means something."
Yeah, we've been burning each other for thousands of years.
Yeah, we've been burning each other for hundreds of years.
Yeah, that's great.
That's when religion means something.
It was great.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. Well,
I love that. And then that's, you know, and his writing, you know, Roger Ebert was a fantastic writer.
Yeah.
You know, he won a Pulitzer Prize. He just, you know, sometimes I read a review and I'm just blown away by it. It's just like, wow, you know, and it's like his whole life, like, again, life itself, you know, all of his experience and everything goes into these reviews, and, I just love to read them. I mean, I still just call them up now and then and read one.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he's got some neat ways to kind of chase those, too, like his great movies list.
He's got a few books. Three books of great movies, which I think there are 100 movies in each book, but maybe I'm wrong. But anyway, they're movies that if you could never see them again, it would make your life worse.
Mm. I love that.
I know that I'll still go look for his reviews also on things. And so he had two kinds of reviews he was really great at. You know, of course, the horrible scathing reviews. Well, not horrible reviews, but reviews of horrible movies.
Yep.
Some of which are some of my favorite movies, by the way, Roger Ebert. So you were wrong about that. And then, you know, of course, his really wonderful reviews of... He just had a way with words, and maybe it's because he was a journalist for so long, and just, you know, practice, you just get really good at that
and
stuff.
Yeah, and he wasn't, well, he had been a journalist in college and everything, and he was handed this job. They said, you know, gosh, we need a movie reviewer. Who's in here? Roger, come here. You know, you're the movie reviewer now for the Chicago Sun-Times. And then he was for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
Could have left, could have gone to the New York Times, whatever. He's like, nah, I don't want to learn different streets.
I love that.
I really thought that was great. It's neat.
And then later, once he was really well known, of course, he, and after Gene Siskel died, there was, I think, is it in the Dallas Museum of Art? Anyway, there was, he basically had the Gene Siskel Memorial film screening every fall.
Wow.
And he would pick his own films and have several days worth of showing them, talking about them with the audience and everything. And one of the films, I just have to say this, one of the films that he reviewed in 2012 was a film called The Curators of Dixon School. It's a documentary that never got much play, and I wish I could see it because my daughter Rose edited it when she was in film school.
Cool. Yeah.
And we said, and he loved it. Got 4 stars. It was done by a friend of his from the Chicago Sun-Times. And we read the review and said, he didn't mention the pacing. Rose, you did a good job.
Oh, that is so neat. I love that.
I know.
I love that. Our very own Rose Davis. Our special correspondent. I think that is so cool. That must have been a thrill.
We couldn't believe it.
That is neat.
Why did we brag?
So awesome.
Well, do you have a favorite review of his or favorite?
Yeah, you know, I was looking through a bunch of them just to see, you know, if I could find something, you know, that, you know, there's moments like that one that I just read about vampires that sticks in your head. But Signs is a movie that I like by M. Night Shyamalan.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got some 1-star views, reviews of M. Night Shyamalan's work as well. But Signs...
Incorrectly, yeah, but...
Signs is a movie that I like. And one that I've considered picking for this podcast several times.
Please do.
So, yeah, so it's a 4-star movie, Roger Ebert did.
Interesting.
Yeah, so, but this is... Here's the opening paragraph. M. Night Shyamalan's Signs is the work of a born filmmaker... able to summon apprehension out of thin air. When it is over, we think not how little has been decided, but how much has been experienced. Here is a movie in which the plot is the rhythm section, not the melody. A movie that stays free of labored explanations and a forced climax, and is about fear in the wind, in the trees, in a dog's bark, in a little girl's reluctance to drink the water, in Signs. I just think that's a beautiful piece of writing. That's a beautiful paragraph. And at the end, he just says, just real quick, at the end of the film, I had to smile, recognizing how Shyamalan has essentially ditched a payoff. He knows, as we all sense, that payoffs have grown boring. The mechanical resolution of a movie's problems is something we sit through at the end, but it's the setup and the buildup that keep our attention. Signs is all buildup. It's still building when it's over.
Mm.
So, you know, I read that and I think, you know, now I got to go see that movie again because I want to see what he's done and understand what Ebert is saying here. But I just love it.
Yeah. Cause he could see things in movies that, I mean, because I still remember I got to go see Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Yeah.
And I got to go see it as a, you know, just a preview.
Yeah.
And write a review about it. And so I really liked it. And then I was like reading all the reviews the next day. And when I saw Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars, I was so relieved. And he says, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter is without a doubt the best film we are ever likely to see on the subject. Unless there is a sequel, which is unlikely because at the end, the Lincolns are on their way to the theater. It's also a more entertaining movie than I remotely expected. Yes, reader, I went expecting to sneer. And at the end he says, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter has nothing useful to observe about Abraham Lincoln, slavery, the Civil War, or much of anything else. Blink, and you may miss the detail that Harriet Tubman's Underground Railway essentially won the war for the North. But the film doesn't promise insights on such subjects. What it achieves is a surprisingly good job of doing justice to its title and treating Lincoln with as much gravity as we can expect under the circumstances.
Nice.
That's not my favorite. I had one for Rio Bravo, but
yeah, I still want to hear your favorite too, but I really like that. Yeah.
Well,
that's neat.
But yeah, to me, that was one where I was like, there's his honesty again.
Yeah.
You know, I went to this, he still went to it, but I liked it anyway. You know, he had that side that could appreciate your basic vampire Abraham Lincoln movie.
Right. And see, you know, and what we're doing right now, you know, talking about these reviews, it's like there's a connection there. And, you know, Roger Ebert is like a facilitator almost. He's a conversation starter. You know, when you see a movie and read one of his reviews, it puts you deeper into the film. And then, you can talk about it. It opens up all kinds of things. And
it's that
I think movies are our common experience, right?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I talked over you.
No, it's okay. Yeah.
Oh, thank goodness, since I think I've done it a lot. But I mean, I think when you want a piece of beautiful writing, Rio Bravo, I love that movie. I don't know if you've seen it.
John Wayne.
Yeah, and Dean Martin, Angie Dickinson, Walter Brennan.
It's been way too long. I don't remember the details, but yeah.
It says, Howard Hawks didn't direct a film for 4 years after the failure of his Land of the Pharaohs in 1955. He thought maybe he had lost it. When he came back to work on Rio Bravo in 1958, he was 62 years old, would be working on his 41st film, and was so nervous on the first day of shooting that he stood behind a set and vomited. Then he walked out and directed a masterpiece. To watch Rio Bravo is to see a master craftsman at work. The film is seamless. There is not a shot that is wrong. It is uncommonly absorbing, and the 141-minute running time flows past like running water. It contains one of John Wayne's best performances. Wayne is effective above all when he simply stands and regards people, and I'd skipped a little bit there. I don't act, I react, he liked to say, and here you see what he meant. His Chance, which is his name, doesn't feel it necessary to impose himself apart from the formidable fact of his presence. He never sweet-talks Feathers, Angie Dickinson, indeed tends to be gruff toward her, but his eyes and body language speak for him. There is a moment when he is angered that she didn't get on the stage out of town, stalks upstairs to her hotel room, barges through the door, and then, in the reverse shot, sees her and transforms his whole demeanor. Can you say a man softens simply by the way he holds himself? With the most subtle of body movements, he unwinds into the faintest beginning of a courtly bow. You don't see it, you feel it.
Wow, that's just something else.
I know, and you just go, I do have to watch that movie again.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, I mean, there's just this quality about his writing that I just absolutely love. So I floated through some of his reviews of bad films, and I found one of my favorites, which is of a recent movie, Transformers Revenge of the Fallen.
Oh, that's mine.
Michael Bay. Is it yours, too?
Yeah, go ahead.
No way. Is it really?
Yeah,
how could we both have picked the same one? I don't know.
Well, because it's so wonderful. It's so wonderfully scathing.
Oh, I'm so surprised. Shoot, we should have got
no,
together.
No, go ahead.
That is too funny. So, I think I would read this and just want to go home if I made this movie.
Yeah.
Paragraph one. Transformers Revenge of the Fallen is a horrible experience of unbearable length, briefly punctuated by three or four amusing moments. One of these involves a dog-like robot humping the leg of the heroine. Such are the meager joys. If you want to save yourself the ticket price, go into the kitchen, cue up a male choir singing the music of hell, and get a kid to start banging pots and pans together. then close your eyes and use your imagination. Oh my gosh.
Yes, that's so wonderful.
That is
and
too funny.
A horrible experience of unbearable length. Well,
that's so funny.
There was another thing, in fact, that I read that was, I think it was Deuce Bigalow, European Gigolo.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if it was that one or the first Deuce Bigalow, but basically some other movie critic, I don't know if you read about this, had really just panned the movie. And unfortunately, the director took it really personally and took out a big ad in Variety. And
well, there's a book that Ebert has called Your Movie Sucks.
Okay.
Is and that in the opening, introduction is all about that. And
okay,
it was, what was, I can't remember the actor's name, who was Deuce Bigalow, but he's the one who took out the ad.
Rob Schneider.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway,
so then Ebert responded.
And then so Ebert, because in the ad he says, "You're nobody. You've got no awards. You've got no this, you know that, blah, blah, blah. How dare you, blah, blah, blah." And Roger Ebert then wrote his review and was like, "Well, I see you did this." He goes, "I happen to have a Pulitzer Prize, and so I believe I'm qualified to tell you your movie sucks." Just like, yes.
Oh, my gosh. That's something.
But one little sentence I did pick up from Deuce Bigalow, European Gigolo review was, "Deuce Bigalow, European Gigolo, makes a living cleaning fish tanks and occasionally prostituting himself. How much he charges, I'm not sure, but the price is worth it if it keeps him off the streets and out of another movie."
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, Roger,
wow.
You were so wicked.
So what is an example of a film that you liked that he panned?
Oh, he hated The Village.
Oh, M. Night Shyamalan's The Village. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't have given that 1 star.
No.
I don't think it was a 4 star, but I didn't hate it.
But I liked it.
Uh-huh.
Liked it pretty well.
Yeah.
And, I think he might have done that to The Lady in the Water. I'm not positive. Which we also liked pretty well. A lot of people didn't like that, but we liked it pretty well.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think of other movies, but oh my gosh, wait a minute. Okay, wait, I take it back. In the movie, and I'm sorry, this guy will never hear it, so it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Thank goodness. This is what I'm glad we're tiny. In the movie, the director of... this Iranian movie called Man Push Cart,
right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Roger Ebert loved this movie, and it was one of the examples that he was very accessible to people. So if you had a movie that you were trying to get him to see, he often would respond if he was at the film festival or, you know, Sundance, I think, is where he saw this. And later on, a woman director talks about meeting him when she was young and then directing a movie that he really liked and helped along. But this guy, he liked him so much that he was a family friend, and he showed up and he was at bedside in the hospital and all this kind of thing. And I'm watching this and he's talking about his movie and how much Roger Ebert helped it. And we didn't even have to see the name of the movie. We saw that man pushing that cart around and we both went, oh no, because it won all these awards. And I read Roger Ebert's glowing review and I went out and rented it. And my family immediately, as soon as we got through, we voted it worst family movie ever.
Wow.
And it took over from a couple things that Rose had picked before. And so she was quite happy to relinquish that place. It's going to take a lot to live that one down.
Wow.
That was one of the most depressing, open-ended, worst movies where not much happens. And, you know, a dead kitten here and there. That
wow.
Kind of thing.
How about that?
Yeah. And so we really all hated that movie.
Yeah.
But it was one of those that was, I think it was more of a movie director's movie than, you know, kind of like listening to jazz, whereas Lisa Simpson says, you have to hear the notes that aren't there.
Yeah.
I don't want to say I'm a simple movie goer. And I like movies like that, too. We watched Calvary and stuff like that.
Sure.
But
yeah.
No, this one didn't have it. Gene Siskel would have agreed with me.
Gene Siskel would have said, what?
He would have said, one of the worst movies ever made. I'll fight you to the death over it.
Yeah. I did think it was admirable how he was accessible like that. You know, he was always looking for, you know, unknowns and things. You know, he delighted in telling people about something that he thought was great.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. That's neat. And he shared our disdain for 3D, which I really liked. In several reviews, you know, he'll throw a paragraph in there about how horrible 3D is. So I'm looking at The Last Airbender, which I have absolutely no idea what happened to this film. You know, I went in wanting to like it, and he's give it half a star.
Oh, no.
But he, again, you know, this is by M. Night Shyamalan. This was something, it was universally panned, this movie.
Right.
And rightly so. I watched it, and it was a mess. But he says, The Last Airbender is an agonizing experience in every category I can think of, and others still waiting to be invented. The laws of chance suggest that something should have gone right. Not here. It puts a nail in the coffin of low-rent 3D, but it will need a lot more coffins than that. And then he started to talk about 3D. He said, let's start with the 3D, which was added as an afterthought to a 2D movie. Not only is it unexploited, unnecessary, and hardly noticeable, but it's a disaster even if you like 3D. M. Night Shyamalan's Retrofit produces the drabbest, darkest, dingiest movie of any sort that I've seen in years. You know something is wrong when the screen is filled with flames that have the vibrancy of faded Polaroids. It is a known fact that 3D causes a measurable decrease in perceived brightness, but Airbender looks like it was filmed with a dirty sheet over the lens.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel in most 3Ds that I watch. I remember watching a animated movie. I think it was Kung Fu Panda 2. This was years ago. And we went to the 3D one, and I would lift up the glasses, and it was so much brighter. You know,
yeah.
It was just like, wow. It turned it into a gray, dingy movie. And I was like, I desperately prefer 2D too. I've never had a good 3D experience yet.
Yeah, there was one movie that we saw that I didn't feel that way about.
Mm-hmm.
And it was The Life of Pi.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the 3D didn't really add much once you got past the credits where they were doing clever things like having animals look over the words and stuff like that. It was really unnecessary. But because of the way the movie was made intending to use all that stuff, it was kind of like I've heard Avatar? Was that James Cameron's movie?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. But I heard that one wasn't really dark because he kind of what they invented a lot of the stuff to use on it. So they made it compensated for it maybe. And Life of Pi seemed to do that too, but it didn't matter. I didn't care. I don't want to go to a 3D movie. I will stand in line to not go to a 3D movie and I will not see a movie if all that there is 3D. So to the none of the Hollywood people who are listening, just take that.
Yeah. And they have to know. I don't know why it's still going on, but I remember the first Avengers movie. It's just a memorable experience because I was standing in line for the 2D version of the movie, and people were walking into the 3D, and they started right around the same time. There was no line. Yeah. They were just walking in, and I was like, well, I mean, who likes... I mean, it's bizarre that it's still going on because it seems to be healthy majority from my unscientific view of people that prefer 2D.
Yeah. I don't know.
It doesn't add anything. I just don't feel like it adds anything to the film. It doesn't make it more real. It makes it unreal.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's like watching one of those little viewfinder things.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
if something's coming out of the screen and you actually turn away or something like that, you're out of the movie. You've started looking at the wall or whatever. You notice that you're in a theater.
Yeah, it pulls your head right out of what you're doing.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So I have no idea how that even came about.
I also hate it. Yeah. I'm on your side.
And Roger Ebert's side.
Roger Ebert's side. He railed on it over and over. Joe Morgenstern's side and everybody else. Hey, I did want to read one little paragraph since we were reading things.
Please.
One of my favorite little bits from his journal where he wrote. The thing about the journal was then he would just go off and write about, you know, his rice cooker, which he was devoted to and did a cookbook for and everything. But he did one for Steak and Shake, which is an Illinois chain that I dearly love. And I guess they've spread out to other places. And he said, if I were on death row, my last meal would be from Steak and Shake. If I were to take President Obama and his family to dinner and the choice were up to me, it would be Steak and Shake. And they would be delighted. If the Pope were to ask where he could get a good plate of spaghetti in America, I would reply, Your Holiness, have you tried the Chili Mac or the Chili Three-Way? It was that.
I love it.
Which when we were taking Rose to Chicago and I saw a Steak and Shake and I was like, oh, we've got to go there. And it was, in fact, delicious. I was so surprised. It
that
was
is
great.
Awesome. Yeah. I recently went to Champaign for work, as you know. Mm-hmm. And there was a Steak and Shake really close to the hotel. So remembering that, I had to go get a Chili Three-Way, and I had it, and it was great. I really liked
it. It's really amazing. And they're they do breakfast now, which they didn't used to. And it's quite good. Yeah. At least we found that on the last trip we were taking up there and back. And it was quite a good breakfast.
Nice. So I'm going to have to try that next time.
Just if you're back there.
Yep. I will be back there.
Oh, I'm so...
Unfortunately.
Maybe you love it. I don't know. Okay.
No disrespect to Illinois. I like it very much, but...
But home is better.
Home is way better. Way more better.
Okay, I was left with a couple of questions from this movie.
Uh-huh.
I realize we've kind of been all over the place, everyone, but you just need to watch it. It's really good.
It is.
Okay, so some are lighter questions and some are more serious.
Okay.
Is it all right?
Yeah, please.
Okay, so at one point there's the jigsaw puzzle that Roger Ebert had that was a gift to him, and he mm-hmm. gave it to the man push cart guy.
Yeah.
The man push cart guy said he had never done the puzzle. He mm-hmm. felt like it wouldn't be the right thing to do. And I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? I would have made that puzzle so fast. Would you make the puzzle, Scott? Would you make the jigsaw puzzle? That's what I want to know.
I probably would not. Not because, I don't know. It was,
all right,
it's because,
Gene, Sistel. No,
it's because just the fact of it.
Nope.
Is what would be important to me. Doing the puzzle wouldn't mean anything to me.
But maybe the original owners did do the puzzle.
And left
then
a secret message?
What they saw. Then
yeah.
You'd be sharing the experience.
That's
with
interesting,
them.
Yeah.
That's how I felt.
That's a good question. I like it. But, okay. But I, you know, yeah. I would have loved to have had that object. That's pretty cool.
Okay.
Yeah, Alfred Hitchcock gave it to Marilyn Monroe, and mm-hmm. now the man push cart guy has it.
But, you know, maybe he'll give it to somebody who can make a sorry good movie. Okay. Yeah, I'm just saying it. That's
no,
where
I'm going to have to watch this.
Channeling Roger Ebert right now, he would have said something like that or worse. Much
right.
more clever, actually.
That's right.
Okay,
too
so
funny.
My second question
mm-hmm.
is, do you have any favorite movie reviewers who you read now? I mean, I never totally relied on Roger Ebert because I knew – I might not agree with him, but he was always my go-to solid guy along with a couple others. Do you have other movies you check?
There's a guy named Matt Zoller Seitz.
Me too.
Oh, no way. Oh, how cool
love
is that?
Him.
I do. I love him a lot.
He's at RogerEbert.com, everyone. You need reading him every
he is.
Week.
He's at RogerEbert.com. I'm not sure where else he is or if that's the only place, but I came across him and I've really liked him.
Mm-hmm.
I also like, there's a guy named A.O. Scott who is actually in this. When I look at the New York Times and I see his name there, I usually read it.
And is that A.L. Scott?
A.O.
A.O. Scott.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's a
Got
New
it.
York Times movie reviewer.
Okay.
I like what he has to say.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I also like Peter Travers from the Rolling Stone.
Who?
Peter Travers.
Peter Travers. I've heard that name.
Reviewer.
I've heard that name, yeah.
He's the one I would always religiously check along with Roger Ebert. I would kind of balance them against each other. And Joe Morgenstern does the Wall Street Journal stuff, or mm-hmm. he probably does a lot of them. I used to like him, but he's gotten really grumpy in the last few years.
That's interesting. Do you allow a movie review to affect whether or not you'll buy a ticket? Like, let's say that Christopher Nolan comes out with a film, and you're like, that looks interesting. But then you read a couple of reviews and say, boy, this was a mess. Would you not go?
Exactly. I did that with Tomorrowland. Poor Brad Bird. I mean, I saw Brad Bird, and I was all over it. And everybody kind of went, and I went, you know what? DVD if then.
Gotcha.
I'll wait and see what people say.
I liked it.
Did you?
I did. I liked it. It's a little atypical, but I liked it. I should look up to see what Matt Zoller Seitz thought of it. But I liked the movie.
Well, I'll probably... It is Brad Bird, and we've watched him since Iron Giant, so...
Yeah. And that's part of it, too. You know, it's like, you know, M. Night Shyamalan. I went and saw The Last Airbender.
Okay, well, see, you're more loyal than I am.
I'm like, fickle. You know, this guy, I like him so much that, you know, I need to see that.
I'm not married to him.
Yeah, yeah. What about things like Rotten Tomatoes? You know,
I will look at them. Tom likes to look at them for things we're renting. And I'll go, ooh, interesting. And I look at them a lot for the movie group that I do.
Yeah.
Because I'm always having to do flyers ahead of time. So I'm trying to find a decent description. And if I haven't seen the movie, I don't want spoilers. And a lot of times that has links to different critics. But the interesting thing about places like that is what I love to see is the percentage of the critics versus the percentage of the audience.
Yeah, and that's the number. Yeah, that's the number that's
interesting. Because sometimes it'll be rotten for the critics, 52%, but it'll be 78% of the audience liked it. And I'm like, I'll take those odds. It might be a popular favorite.
Right.
You know, or if it's the other way, I'll, you know, take it too. I'll go, I'll take those critic odds, you know.
Yeah.
So it just depends.
And that's an interesting thing, you know, it's like Goodreads, you know.
Yeah.
I don't have like a book reviewer like I like movie reviewers. There's nobody that I follow you know, constantly other than somebody like, you know, Jenny or somebody like that.
Right, like friends.
Right, friends. Oh. But when you go to Goodreads, like if there's a book that, you know, boy, I wonder if someone has read this, you know, you can go to Goodreads and then you can see that means a lot to me. And maybe it shouldn't, because I know that some publishers can game that, I've heard, you know, with the Amazon reviews and stuff. I can't imagine that it would be easy to do on Goodreads. But Goodreads is part of Amazon.
But they don't seem to have messed with it much.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope not.
It's
That's good.
It's funny, because I actually will often go to Amazon before I go. After I've seen the movie, before the movie group, I will go and look at, you know, what different critics said, because I'm not so smart that I can pick up all these nuances and themes, and those things will get mentioned. I'll go, oh, yeah. And surprisingly, Amazon is a really good place for movies that if you look at the top two or three, you can get people who are making surprisingly deep and nuanced comments.
Oh, and that's neat.
Yeah.
I should do that. I don't do that now. I got kind of turned off doing that because I kept running into, you know, one star, received this and the plastic was off or something, you know, and you're like, oh, come on.
Like, that's not what they want to know.
Yeah,
people.
That's not what we're talking about.
But that's kind of got an interesting combination, because since you can look at, they've got the little graph now for the 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 stars, you can look at they'll show you the percentages. So say 400 people reviewed something. And I'll look at it and go, oh, between the 4 and 5 star reviews, there are 78% people in that spot. I'm like, I like those odds.
Yeah.
So let me read a couple of the descriptions, hopefully with no spoilers, and see if with a little more information, I can find out what I want to know. Because, I mean, I'm also trying to look for movies for that group too sometimes.
Yeah, sure.
So,
yeah. But we're always looking for movies.
So I do the Rotten Tomatoes percentages thing with those Amazon things, too.
Oh, that's neat.
Or just to buy something for myself.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, on my phone when I'm looking, like if I was going to go to a movies tonight or something, I have the app, I can't remember what it's called, to see what movie times are and stuff. And that's connected to tomatoes. So, you know, it's like, you know, Pitch Perfect 2, 50%, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. And what I can't wait to see is the latest Pixar movie, which is like in the 90s for both.
Oh, me too.
So we'll be seeing that this weekend, I believe.
And Mad Max. I'm going to try to.
Mad Max has just gotten outrageous reviews. And see, now there's an example of a movie that I wouldn't even have considered going to.
Agreed.
Without the hearing all that stuff, you know. And
right.
So there's the opposite happening.
Well, I also would like to mention two other reviewers. I have several others, and so we'll just put links to them.
Great.
But I did want to mention Joseph Suzenka who a long time ago was on this podcast, and he
does
that not
man. Sorry, go ahead.
Joseph, we need more reviews from you, buddy. He used to review things more often, and now he tends to do like quick overviews of things mm-hmm. on his blog. But he has started making little notes. Yeah, because I'm going to out you right now. He has started making notes to himself in Letterboxd after he's watched stuff.
Oh, cool.
And so we've started having little conversations in his comments boxes occasionally. In fact, that's what made me think of M. Night Shyamalan for stuff, because he'd rewatched The Village and said, I know a lot of people hated it, but I still like it. And I was like, me too, you know.
I love that. That's
and then
great.
The other one is Stephen, I can't remember his middle initial. He always uses a D, Gray Danis.
Oh,
Danis,
yeah.
And mm-hmm. I'm not saying his name right. Sorry, yep. I know. But he is somebody who Roger Ebert really respected, and he's a well-known Catholic reviewer, where he kind of does what we do. He'll look at the movie, and then he'll go, and here are these other themes in there that work for the Catholic audience or don't work or whatever.
That's cool. So who does he write for now? Does he – I mean, he actually does that and for – yeah, National Catholic Register, it looks like. Is that
yeah,
right?
He's also sometimes in Catholic Digest, and he's on Crux sometimes,
yeah.
Which is – he does video, DVD, just out kind of things.
I love it.
Or he'll do – like when Christopher Lee died, he did a really good overview of his career.
Yeah, I'm looking
had
at that right
nice
now.
Link to,
the Extraordinary Career of Christopher Lee in Crux. And his latest one is Pixar and the Pope, WALL-E and Laudato
right.
Si.
Right. So yep. If you go to his decentfilms.com, and we'll have links to these things, but mm-hmm. he'll have, you know, how you can get to all these things. You can see his commentary versus his reviews. And I do like his stuff. I'm pretty opinionated. There's nobody I agree with totally, but
yeah, sure.
He's pretty good.
Cool.
So I did want to mention them. So.
Yeah, I'm glad you did.
Okay, my last question is much more difficult.
Okay, I'm ready.
Or maybe it's not difficult, but it's more serious.
Okay,
so Chaz talked about being there and what they did when Roger Ebert died.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been present when somebody has died? Because that's not something a lot of Americans do.
Yeah, I have not.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. How about you?
I have, which is what made me think of asking it. When Tom's mm-hmm. mother died, she sank into a, I guess it was a coma, although she was pretty active in the coma. But anyway, on a Friday, and she didn't die till the Saturday afternoon. So we were there sitting vigil with her for quite a long time. And when she died, it was almost the way Chaz described it, because, they basically just said, you know, really what would probably be the right thing to do is turn off the oxygen. She's done. She waited. She stayed alive and more alert and everything as much as she could be until the last son who could get there got there.
Wow.
And an hour later, everything changed.
Hmm.
Yeah. And so they turned off the oxygen, and Hannah sat on the bed next to her and held her hand. Mm-hmm. And we sat there and with each other holding hands and stuff, and I was praying and Hannah was praying, and she breathed her last. And it was incredibly sad, but incredibly wonderful at the same time, because she had a long life and she was worn out and it was time for her to go. It was a natural death. And you don't want to say something that sounds so callous as I recommend it, but it's not something to be afraid of. It is, as Roger Ebert said, the other part of the thing about I've had a long, rich life was, and death is a part of it.
Yeah.
And I feel richer for having been there with her in that moment of her life.
Wow. So. That is something. Yep.
Yeah.
Incredible. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, you're welcome. It's like I say, I was telling a young priest about it later, and I said, well, it was, you know, we spent the whole day and we would be there and talk to her. She was in a coma, but we talked to her and we were picking out, you know, I think this dress would be good, you know, that kind of thing. But at the same time, we're looking at pictures and we're laughing over memories. So she was there with us. Not dead yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, so we cried, but we were incredibly sad, but we're incredibly happy. And he goes, well, that's like all of them. And I was kind of taken aback for a minute, because I was like, whoa, man, you just change my experience into something everyone has. And then I went, I kind of love that that's what everyone has.
Yeah.
It's like a birthday or somebody being born. You don't think, oh, because I was so happy and other people were so happy, it makes it worse or it takes away from the uniqueness. It's just, oh, this is a human experience that you go through. So,
wow. Incredible.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's something.
But this movie left me with so many thoughts about all three of the threads that were through there that it was really something that I thought about for a couple of days afterwards. My husband and I would talk to each other about it for a couple of days. So
yeah, well, good.
There's a lot more to it than just, you know, I say just, but you know, a simple storytelling of somebody's life.
Yeah. And that's how I felt about it too, which is why I picked it. After I saw it, I was like, oh, well, I've got to pick this. Obviously.
Yeah, great choice.
Yeah. So I'm glad. I'm glad you liked it. And I'm glad you got something out of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Me too. I love Roger Ebert more than ever.
As do I.
Probably more than if I'd have met him in person. I'm for sure we would have fought at some point. But despite what Chaz said.
That's too awesome. I love it.
That's not a good quality. No, we don't want to encourage that.
Oh, too funny.
Everyone in my family's like, no, stop it, Scott. No, don't encourage him.
Don't encourage her.
Yeah.
I love it. All right. Well, that, I guess, is the end of this podcast. So what do we got coming up next is a book, The Caine Mutiny.
Boy, matey.
The Caine Mutiny by Herman Wouk.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
I've begun it. It's quite good.
Good. Yep. And I have to for the second time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then July... Oh, yeah. 2 weeks after that, we're going to do The Dirty Dozen.
I didn't think of a World War II theme, but we seem to be going there for a while.
Which is fine. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. Oh, that's going to be a lot of fun to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
The Dirty Dozen. Awesome. And then after that, what have you got for us?
Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Yeah, there we go. Cool.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I just published a list of the 10 books that have influenced me most of my life, and that's one of them.
Oh, good. Neat.
Can't wait to talk about it.
Cool. I'm excited.
As you're all tired of hearing. Oh, good.
Yvette.
I hope you're excited.
I am. I really am. Yep. That's a book that I probably never would have read, which is something that I love about doing this podcast. So
yeah.
It's going to be great.
I know. I could have sworn I read The Caine Mutiny before, but I think I probably said that, but I'm reading this going, I don't remember, if so, a single word. So this is all new.
I'm glad you're enjoying it, because, I do like it a lot.
Yeah.
So.
That's good.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening.
Yes. Thank you very much.
All right. And we will see you next time.
Yeah. See you soon.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.